I'll send more information after I've taken them aboard my ship. The screen went blank, leaving Amanda awash in a thousand questions. But none of them mattered to her. Lars is all right, and he's not doing anything dangerous. He's going to rescue George and his crewman, and then he'll come back here, back to me. She felt enormously relieved.
The airlock compartment felt cramped, crowded, once George and his crewman came through the hatch in their bulky spacesuits. And as soon as they started pulling off their suits, Fuchs nearly gagged from the stench. "You'll both need showers," he said, as delicately as he could manage. George grinned sheepishly through his wildly tangled beard. "Yeah, guess we don't smell so sweet, eh?" The Asian said nothing but looked embarrassed. He was only a youngster, Fuchs saw. As Fuchs led them along the passageway to the lav, George said cheerfully, "Hope you've got a full ladder." Fuchs nodded, resisting the urge to hold his nose. Then he asked, "What happened to you?" Shooing the silent Nodon into the shower stall, George answered, "What happened? We were attacked. That's what happened. Attacked. Deliberately shot to pieces by a bloke with a high-power laser on his ship." "I knew it," Fuchs muttered. Nodon discreetly stepped into the shower stall before peeling off his coveralls. And then they heard the spray of water, saw tendrils of steamy air rising from the stall. "I guess we're not the first to be chopped," said George. "Lady of the Lake, Aswan, 4 or 5 others at least." "At least," Fuchs agreed. "We'll have to inform the IAA of this. Maybe now they'll start a real investigation." "Dinner first," George said. "My stomach's growling." "A shower first," Fuchs corrected. "Then you can eat." George laughed. "Suits me." Raising his voice, he added, "If we can get a certain Asian bloke out of the fucking shower stall."
Harbin was glistening with perspiration as he exercised on the ergonomics bike. Shanidar was cruising at 1/6 G, the same grav level as the moon. But Harbin's military upbringing unsparingly forced him to maintain his conditioning to Earth normal standards. As he pedaled away and pumped at the handbars, he watched the display screen on the bulkhead in front of him. It was a martial arts training vid, one that Harbin had seen dozens of times, but each time he picked up something new, some different little wrinkle that he had overlooked before or forgotten. After his mandatory 20 clicks on the bike, he would rerun the vid and go through its rigorous set of exercises. But his mind kept coming back to the central problem he faced. How can I prevent Fuchs from informing Ceres of what happened to Waltzing Matilda? He's already sent one brief message to his wife. Once he beams out their whole story, the IAA will launch a full investigation. Almost, he smiled. If that happens, my career in piracy is finished. Grigor's superiors might even decide that it would be safer to terminate me than to pay me off. It's imperative, then, that I silence star power as quickly as possible. But how? I can't jam their transmissions. I don't have the proper equipment aboard. I could accelerate, get to them at top speed, knock them out before they get a message back to Ceres. But then I'd be too low on fuel to get back to a tanker. I'd have to signal Grigor to send a tanker to me. And what better way to be rid of me than to let me drift alone out here until I starve to death or the recyclers break down? That way Grigor and his HSS bosses get total silence for free. With a grim shake of his head, Harbin decided he would continue on his present course and speed. He'd catch up to star power and destroy the ship. Fuchs would die. Harbin only hoped that he could finish the job before Fuchs told Ceres what was going on. That's in the lap of the gods, he thought. It's a matter of chance. A quatrain from the Rubaiyat came to him. Ah, love, could thou and I with fate conspire to grasp this sorry scheme of things entire? Would not we shatter it to bits, and then remold it nearer to the heart's desire? Yes, Harbin thought, that would be pleasant, to shatter this world to bits and rebuild it into something better. To have a woman to stand beside me, to love me, to be my heart's desire. But that is fantasy, he told himself sternly. Reality is this godforsaken emptiness, this dreary ship. Reality is studying ways to kill. With a deep, heartfelt breath, he said silently, "Reality is this damned bike, going nowhere, but taking all my energy to get there."
Fuchs sat in the galley, nearly stunned with amazement as he watched George wolf down enough food to feed an ordinary man for a week. The crewman, Noden, ate more sparingly, but still put away a good pile of rations. "Then after he slagged our antennas," George was saying through a mouthful of veggie burger and reconstituted potatoes, "he zapped the Fuchs thruster nozzle and for good measure popped our propellant tanks."
"He was very thorough," Fuchs said.
George nodded.
"I figure he must have thought we were still inside the hab module. Noden and me played doggo until he left. By then old Matilda was drifting in the general direction of Alpha Centauri."
"He assumed you were dead."
"Or as good as."
"You've got to tell all this to the IAA, said Fuchs.
"If we'd had a cutting laser on board, I would have shot back at the bastard. He caught us with the laser sitting on the roid and our power pack being recharged."
"I have your laser," Fuchs said. "It's in the cargo bay." Noden looked up from his food.
"I will check it out."
"You do that," George agreed. "I'll call up the IAA people in Cellini."
"No," said Fuchs. "We'll call IAA headquarters on Earth. This story must be told to the top people, and quickly."
"Okay. Soon's I polish off some dessert. What you got in the freezer?"
Turning to Noden, Fuchs said, "I'm carrying a cutting laser, too. It's stored in the cargo bay, along with yours."
The Asian asked softly, "Do you want me to connect them both to the power sources?"
Fuchs saw calm certainty in the young man's hooded brown eyes. "Yes. I think it might be wise to have them both operational."
George caught their meaning as he got up and stepped to the freezer. "How are you going to fire them from inside the cargo bay, mate?"
"Open the hatches, obviously," said Fuchs.
"Better wear a suit, then."
Noden dipped his chin in silent agreement.
"You both think he'll be back, then?" said Fuchs.
"Perhaps," Noden answered.
"Better to be ready if and when,"
George said as he scanned the inventory list on the freezer's display screen.
"I don't want to be caught with me pants down again. Could be fatal."
Diane Fairford could see that her boss was getting cold feet. Martin Humphreys looked uncomfortable, almost nervous, as he entered the spacious living room of his mansion. "How do I look?" he asked her, something he never did ordinarily. He was dressed in a full-fledged tuxedo, complete with a bow tie and plaid cummerbund. She smiled, suppressing the urge to tell him he looked like a chubby penguin. "You look very debonair," she said. "Damned silly business. You'd think that after a couple of centuries they'd figure out something better to wear for formal occasions." "I'm impressed that you knotted the tie so perfectly." He frowned at her. "It's pre-tied, and you know it. Don't be cute." Fairford was wearing a floor-length sheath of glittering silver. Its long skirt slit nearly to the hip. "Stavanger didn't invite me to the damned opera out of the goodness of his heart," Humphreys complained as they headed for the door. "He wants to pump me about something, and he thinks I'll be off my guard in a social setting." "Cocktails and dinner, and then il trovatore," Fairford murmured. "That's enough to relax you to the point of stupefaction." "I hate opera," he grumbled as he opened the door. Stepping out into the garden behind him, Fairford asked, "Then why did you accept his invitation?" He glared at her. "You know why. Pancha's going to be there. Stavanger's got something up his sleeve. He may be officially retired, but he still runs Cellini, the power behind the throne. He lifts an eyebrow and everybody hops to do what he wants." As they walked through the lush shrubbery and trees that filled the grotto, Fairford said, "I wonder what it is that he wants now." Humphreys threw a sour glance at her. "That's what I pay you to find out."
The cocktail reception was out in the open, under the dome of the Grand Plaza next to the amphitheater that housed all of Cellini's theatrical productions. When Humphreys and Fervord arrived, Pancho Lane was standing near the bar, deep in earnest conversation with Douglas Stavanger. Nearly twice Humphreys's age, Doug Stavanger still looked as young and vigorous as a 30.